Good evening and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Ted O'Brien. Consider for a moment the quantum, a bundle of energy, an indivisible unit that can be sliced no more. It underlies our understanding of the physical world, and yet it remains mysterious. Our understanding of the world's continually being stretched and tested by our changing knowledge of how the world works, how it all fits together. So what's our understanding today? Have recent discoveries challenged the assumptions of the past decades? What new hypotheses are being advanced to explain a universe expanded to include objects so far away that they're older than the light we normally see by? And how can everyday folk, you, me, get our minds around these matters? We need help of the highest order, and tonight we have it. In three extraordinary minds that have long contemplated physics, astronomy, and astrophysics. From Boston University, Arthur G.B. Metcalf, professor of mathematics and the sciences, Sheldon Glashow, whose work in electroweak theory was honored with a Nobel Prize in 1979. Dr. Margaret Geller, senior scientist at the Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory, a MacArthur Grant recipient, and co-discoverer of the Great Wall of Galaxies that is redefining our place in the universe. And MIT Professor of Science and Writing Alan Lightman, an astrophysicist and author of Einstein's Dreams and The Diagnosis, which was a finalist for the National Book Award last year. Thank you all for joining me here tonight.
Oh, thanks, Ted.
It's a pleasure.
Now, when I went to school, we were taught that everything was made up of atoms, protons and neutrons that made up the nucleus, the center of the atom, and electrons. The electrons spun around the nucleus like planets orbit the sun. But this isn't the picture today. For just one thing, it turns out the protons and neutrons are made up of still more fundamental things, now called quarks, and the new understanding is called the Standard Model. So, let's begin by asking, what is the Standard Model, and how did we come to have it as our model? In other words, what's our understanding today of what everything is made of and how it all holds together?
Okay, Ted, I guess that's a question I should begin to answer.
Professor Glashow.
Well, of course, the way you described your early education was not quite right. Even back then, however long it was, people knew that electrons were not going around their nuclei like planets. It's different. It's quantum mechanical.
I wondered why I got a C in that course.
But, and at the same time, I was reading the Encyclopedia Britannica and reading about electrons, and it said that every electron is the same as every other electron, and that as if they're made from a perfect factory. And this was indeed a great mystery. That's a mystery which has been solved by quantum mechanics and relativity. We understand why all electrons are the same. The trouble is that we have a lot of other particles around. We have neutrons and protons, for example. Once they were thought to be elementary particles. And with them, we could make nuclei, and with nuclei and electrons, we could make atoms, et cetera, et cetera. But they're not elementary. They're made of quarks. And making a very long story very short, it turns out that there are six different kinds of quarks. You're made of just up quarks and down quarks, Ted. And
right.
So am I.
Right.
But there are strange quarks and charmed quarks and top quarks and bottom quarks. Well, six.
So what is quantum mechanics and how does it fit in? What does it explain?
In brief, I could say it explains everything.
Yes.
It's an extraordinarily successful underpinning to our understanding of physics at all levels, from the micro world, from elementary particles, to the large structures that my friends here like to study, galaxies and clusters of galaxies, and the universe as a whole. So it's a language, a theory, if you will, but a language that allows us to describe everything, no matter how small or how big.
Alan?
Well, I think of quantum mechanics as, in addition to enabling us to understand everything, it introduces some particular ways of understanding that violate common sense and our whole previous conception of reality. And one of the ways that it violated our common understanding of the world is that objects, particles, don't have particular specific locations in space. They behave as if they could be in several places at the same time. And this totally upturns our nature of what reality is. The smaller the object, the more easy it is for the objects to be in many places at the same time. When you get a very large object like a chair, it's very hard for it to be at two places at the same time, and that's what our intuition is based upon. So when Professor Glashow says that quantum mechanics applies to the whole universe, it does, but the effects of quantum mechanics are stranger on the subatomic level than in the macroscopic world that we live with our automobiles and coffee cups. Another idea of quantum mechanics for me, which is related to that idea, is that we cannot predict things with certainty, that because objects can be at many places of the same at the same time, we can only give a probability for where objects will be, for how fast they will be moving, and that in turn translates to a predictability of the future based on the past. Before quantum mechanics, we thought that if you had enough information about a physical system, such as a group of particles, you could predict the future of where that system would be. And we know that you can no longer do that.
Alan said correctly that quantum mechanics gets stranger when things get smaller. And once upon a time, Isaac Newton invented what's called classical mechanics. And we like to say, some people say that there have been revolutions which undercut classical mechanics. It's been replaced by quantum mechanics or by relativity or something like that. But I would take a very different point of view and say that Newton's mechanics has been proven to be correct in the only way a theory can be proven correct, namely its envelope of applicability, where it works, has been precisely defined. If things are too small, quantum mechanics plays a role. If things move too fast, special relativity plays a role. And if things get too big, general relativity plays a role. But if you're in the middle, the way we are in our cars and our planet and our everyday...
And even galaxies.
We don't really have to worry very much about quantum mechanics or special relativity or general relativity.
From a practical point of view, from the point of view of somebody who observes the universe, you could say that understanding of quantum mechanics first enables us to observe the universe as we do it today, because the devices that we use to detect light are quantum mechanical devices.
That's a very good
point. Couldn't
have
been developed without understanding quantum mechanics. And in fact, when you go out and use your digital camera or the internet, you're using the kinds of devices which we use today to observe ancient light, which has been traveling to us for hundreds of millions or billions of years. And we also understand the messages that that light carries by knowing about quantum mechanics. So when we look at objects in the universe, all the information we have essentially is carried to us by this ancient light, and it contains the signatures of what the universe is made of. And we interpret those signatures because we know about quantum mechanics.
So the messages that are carried by this light are what it was in the past?
Well, the light comes to us from objects which are distant. So, for example, if we look toward the center of our galaxy, the center of our galaxy is some 20,000 light years away, which means that we see the light at the center of our galaxy as it was 20,000 years ago. If we look at a nearby galaxy, the nearest galaxy to us is of order a million light years away. So we see it as it was a million years ago. If we look at the distant universe, we see farther into the past.
Astronomers don't like to brag, but what you're saying, Margaret, is that a telescope is a time machine.
Yes. Yes, so a telescope. And of course, we can only interpret these signatures because we make a very bold assumption when we observe the universe. We make the assumption that the physics that we derive and test in laboratories on Earth applies everywhere in the universe.
And every when.
And every when. And so that is really a bold assumption, and we look for contradictions to that assumption. I mean, to me, it's sort of amazing.
We've tested it in the most remarkable ways. You know about the first nuclear reactor, for example, in Gabon, in Africa.
That I don't know.
It wasn't a man-made reactor. It reacted a billion years ago or so. It was just a region where the concentration of uranium was anomalously high, and it began to be a reactor. And today, all of the end products of that nuclear reactor are still there and have been carefully studied. And the distribution of isotopes of samarium, which is one of the fission products, is exactly what would have been expected, what one expects today. And it turns out that this particular element is very sensitive. It has a little resonance which would have been different if things were a little bit different. And this tells us that basically nothing changed in the laws of physics for a billion years.
Which was very comforting, I would guess, after...
Mm-hmm. But also, I think that there are a number of examples where scientists badly wanted something, a result, to come out a certain way, and it didn't come out that way. Albert Michelson badly wanted the existence of an ether, a medium that light traveled through, and he kept misinterpreting his experiments and repeating his experiments because he didn't accept the result that apparently there was no ether. And the fact that sometimes our experimental results come out different from what we badly wish shows to me that we're not just constructing sandcastles in the sky. We're not just making up the science, that there's something real there.
This happens again and again in physics. You gave one example. We can give many, many other examples of circumstances where someone discovers something contrary to what he or she wishes, such as the positron. Carl Anderson did not want to find this particle, but he found it nonetheless. Or Becquerel and the discovery of radioactivity. He was looking for X-rays coming out of material exposed to sunlight, nothing to do with radioactivity. Found it by complete accident.
It seems to me that in some ways there is sort of a deep mystery about science, a kind of romantic mystery in a way, it's always seemed to me, and that is that we can do it, that human beings ask questions about nature, and even more so that they can answer these questions about nature. You know, you could have it that the Earth was inhabited by creatures who don't ask such questions, and even if they could answer them, they wouldn't ask them, they wouldn't be able to answer them. And so, to me, in a way, that's the most profound mystery about science.
On that note, I will say that this is Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Ted O'Brien, and our guests are Boston University physics Nobelist Sheldon Glashow, Smithsonian astrophysicist and MacArthur Grant recipient Margaret Geller, and the past director of MIT's Science Writing Program and professor of science and writing, Alan Lightman. Well, all right. We've talked about the what. Now let's talk about the where. Where are we? What does the universe look like? And I guess we have to go back to the beginning, the Big Bang. It's cooled off into stars and galaxies and everything else we know. Today, the universe is still expanding, but what does it look like? What does it really look like, Margaret Geller?
Well, I think one of the wonderful things about the universe is that galaxies like our own Milky Way are arranged in very large patterns, which extend for hundreds of millions of light years. And today we live in the age when we can actually observe those patterns. I like to say that galaxies are arranged as though they're on the surfaces of giant bubbles like the suds in your kitchen sink, but these bubbles are a few hundred million light years across, and there are walls full of galaxies and strings of galaxies and big concentrations of galaxies, and people have come a very long way in actually mapping what the universe around us looks like. You could say we can now write our address in the modern-day universe, the local universe, the more or less 15-billion-year-old universe that we live in. This question, I think, from the observational point of view and from the theoretical point of view, has shifted from what does the universe look like to how did it get to be this way, And fortunately for us, we can observe it directly because, as Shelley said, the universe is a time machine. So if we look out in space, we look back in time and we can actually see how the universe was 1 billion years ago, 5 billion years ago, 10 billion years ago, 15 billion years ago. In fact, we can see back to the time when the universe was only a few 100,000 years old. And the universe is transparent back to that age, and we can see everything that's in it. I like to say that one of the reasons we can see so well is that the universe is amazingly empty, that if the seats in Fenway Park were distributed like galaxies in the universe, there'd be 3 seats in Fenway Park.
So it would be almost as if it were a shotgun shell first formed, and then when fired, sends these things all out into space?
Not exactly. Not exactly. Because the shotgun, if the various pieces of the shotgun shell all started at the same point. But that is, there's a point which you can say, hey, there's the center. There is no center. It happened.
It happens everywhere all at the same time. And the space in the universe is what's dynamic. And this is the thing that's sort of... kind of deep thing about Einstein's theory of general relativity, that space isn't the thing that we're used to, that we walk around in, that it's really dynamic, and that the reason that galaxies appear to separate from one another is that the space between them is stretching. And this is a very difficult...
It's not only curved, but stretching.
It's curved and stretching.
It sounds like
and
a balloon.
And has ripples, and then has, yes.
Well, it's a balloon with no outside.
Yeah, no outside or inside, only the surface.
And it's three-dimensional unless it happens to be 11-dimensional.
Right. So, and it has a lot of ripples in it, wherever there's mass around.
Right.
Well, at this point, I'm going to quote from one of Professor Lightman's books, in which he talks about thinking about these things. And a world without bodies, a world of clear logic and grace. It's the best part of loneliness. Without the sadness.
I was speaking about, I think, more about the theoretical scientist. Margaret can speak on this. Observers tend to work with a few people. Theoretical scientists tend to work by themselves. And there is a magnificent sense of power and joy, and Professor Glashow knows much more about this than I do. But when you learn something that no one else knows, and you've done it, you've done some calculation, it could happen with an observer as well, an experimentalist. For a while, before you tell your colleagues, before you publish your results, there's a tremendous sense of power, but it's not an ego power. It's an ego-free thing somehow that's magnificent, that creative moment when you've learned something that no one else knows.
Let me give a for instance along those very lines. Once upon a time, my colleagues and I invented the idea of charm as a fourth kind of quark. We were very proud having increased the number of kinds of quarks from 3 to 4, but the real answer is 6. That's another story. But once upon a time... before the community believed in charm, I walked into an office in Harvard where there were 4 of my colleagues having an argument about the detailed properties of charmed particles. And I said, I can't believe this. I have a room full of people who believe my theory. And it's that kind of excitement that it turned out to be right, the theory, that kind of excitement that Alan is talking about.
I guess I have always been attracted to science because I've always been interested in patterns and geometry, and I'm very more visual, I would say. And I've done primarily, even though I've worked on problems which treat dynamics of systems and so on, my approach is generally sort of a geometric one. And what I've always enjoyed is the beauty of the patterns in nature, and I guess that I've always felt sort of humbled by them, and that I really feel, I remember that when we had the first slice of our map, and I thought, you know, why me? Why are we the first 3 people to see this extraordinary beauty of nature? I mean, these are the largest patterns that we know in nature, and It's a kind of, for me, it was a kind of high, and maybe, you know, it's a kind of romantic. I felt really a kind of awe that one can discover these things and then use them to understand, you know, what the universe is like and how it came to be.
What about that moment? Describe what you saw and what you felt when you saw that great wall of galaxies.
Well, the funny thing is that the context really was that people really didn't think that there were such enormous patterns.
Normal person would imagine that the galaxies are randomly distributed.
Well, people knew from Hubble's day that there were clusters of galaxies which extend for a mere few million light years. And I mean, that's small in the scale of the universe. And they thought that was it, and that the clusters were more or less randomly distributed on a sea of galaxies. That was the idea. And, of course, you know, I was trained at the places where people knew the answers, but I realized that one of the reasons people thought that is that they, of course, hadn't been able to really look. And my colleagues, John Hocker and Valerie de Lepre, and I were fortunate to be in a position where we really could take a look. And the odd thing was that John and I were so sure that the idea people had, they were so sure that that idea was right, we didn't look at the data till they were all in hand. And so I remember seeing the plot of the distribution of galaxies in this tiny slice of the universe, and it was really thrilling to see this very clear pattern, because fortunately nature was very kind to us, because had the pattern not been clear, we wouldn't have noticed it. And people had had hints before, and because it wasn't so clear and because there was a prejudice against seeing these patterns, people really didn't latch on to these very large-scale patterns. I mean, it was really a thrilling thing. And then that night I lay awake thinking, what could this mean that you have this thin slice, and what could it mean about the geometry, the way that galaxies are arranged? And it was that evening that I thought, well, it must mean that you have these big dark regions that are more or less surrounded with galaxies. That looks like bubbles.
What scale do the patterns stop? Now, we have some idea now.
Well, you know, it's on a scale of hundreds of millions of light years.
That brings us to the real puzzle, which is being addressed today in real time. Your work and those of your colleagues shows that there's structure at practically all scales.
Yes, that's right.
We all know that there's structure at small scales. I mean, you look at any object, it's made of things. It's not homogeneous. It's made of atoms. At large scales, there are rocks and mountains. At larger scales, there are planets. There are solar systems. There are galaxies. There are clusters of galaxies. There are superclusters of galaxies. And this extends, if not to the size of the universe itself, to a good fraction of the size of the universe.
A large fraction of it, yes.
And yet, contrary-wise, and I'm approaching something that you were about to mention, contrary-wise, the universe, when it was very young, a million years old, was very smooth and almost completely without structure, like a baby's skin. So how did this supernally smooth universe develop lumpiness at all scales? And this was, and to a certain extent still is, kind of a mystery.
I'm chuckling because knowing something of aging.
Yeah, you get lumpier.
You get structure at all scales.
I just want to say that you're listening to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Ted O'Brien. Our guests are Alan Lightman of MIT, Margaret Geller of the Smithsonian Astrophysical Laboratory, and Sheldon Glashow, Boston University's Physics Department. We circle a rather ordinary star close to the outer edge of a rather ordinary galaxy. Then what?
And then we're on the edge of a more or less ordinary cluster.
We're nowhere, in a word.
Yeah. Okay. We're not special.
Well, all right. Then a couple of questions that go back to the what. First, strings. What is string theory? What does it help explain? Are strings just speculation, a fudge factor that helps equations work out to the expected answer, or is there some evidence for strings?
Oh, there's certainly no evidence for string theory, but in point of fact, nobody in this room has the faintest idea of what superstring theory is, I think, or at least speaking for myself.
Alan,
okay. String theory is a very ambitious attempt to create a theory which unifies the general theory of relativity with everything else that we know. And as it does not as yet make any experimental prediction at all, and is therefore not science in the conventional sense in that it is not falsifiable, they would disagree. They would say it predicts the existence of gravity, which you know exists, but that's not really a prediction.
It's a post-diction. We already knew that gravity existed.
We already knew
that. We had some hints.
it's real exciting stuff. It is physics, but we don't do it at BU.
All right. Professor Lightman and Professor Geller don't do it either.
There are a lot of great physicists who do it.
They dream of this unified theory, and if the dream ever becomes a reality, it will be wonderful. They have posed a serious conundrum, and that is whether the laws of physics are unique, whether there is a single set of universal laws that applies to everything. That is to say, they imagine that there are other universes, that the exact values of fundamental constants and the laws that that quantities obey, all of those things are accidents of nature, just as the distance between the Earth and the Sun is an accident of nature. And among all the possible laws of physics, the ones that we observe are of necessity the ones that are compatible with the fact that a species has evolved that can ask the question of what the laws of physics are.
That's one possibility. And the other possibility is that the laws of physics can't be other than what they are, that the fundamental constants can't be other than what they are.
That's what you and I would like, and that's what everybody would like, but we don't know if it's true.
Well, I wouldn't mind the accidental universe either. It's less satisfying to a physicist. Physicists would like to be able to deduce everything from pure thought and not have any accidents determine the universe, but we don't know which of those two paths will be the right path.
We don't know if we'll be able to answer the question of why are there six quarks, not seven, six kinds of quarks.
Anyway, don't all the important things like love and so on happen by accident?
I hope so.
Our guests are Sheldon Glashow of Boston University, Margaret Geller from the Smithsonian Astrophysical Laboratory in Cambridge, and Alan Lightman of the MIT Science and Writing Program. A little while ago, Margaret, you started to get to the question of dark mass or dark matter. What is it? Is it wimps or machos or?
She doesn't know.
I wish I knew.
No, there's the problem. That's why we can't have a theory.
The amazing thing about this dark stuff is that it was discovered that it was there in 1933.
By astronomers.
It's not new.
By astronomers.
It was discovered by an astronomer named Fritz Zwicky.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
And it's been with us ever since. And not only that, but amazingly enough, with a very small amount of data, he got more or less the answer we get today. So he had, due to a conspiracy of errors, but nonetheless.
Terrible come down for astronomers because they used to think that they were looking at the stuff of the universe, but they're looking at the contaminants of the universe, the quarks and stuff that make up a few percent of the mass of the universe. The rest, the stuff they can't look at, is something else, and we don't know what.
All right. I use the word wimps and machos advisedly. Could somebody explain that for me?
Well, WIMP, W-I-M-P, weakly interacting massive particle.
All right, very weakly interacting
massive
particle.
Well, interacting by my favorite kinds of interactions, which is the force that I studied when I was a kid, the weak interactions.
I see.
And heavy particles that have only weak interactions. Are they particles of this kind? People are looking. We'll get an answer in a few years.
And machos?
Machos are massive
compact halo objects. So the universe, you know, there are lots of objects in the universe that don't give any light on their own.
Human beings,
for example, washing machines. But there are a variety of objects that are remnants of the evolution of stars. The stars leave behind when they've burned out all their nuclear fuel. They leave behind remnants which don't give out any light. And these things could be in the halo of our galaxy, the outer regions of our galaxy, and they have mass, but they don't produce much light.
So I'm getting a picture now of the universe with junk left over, burned out stars, but with a lot of unexplained material in it.
Most of the material, 98%, or is it 99%?
Most, depending on, most of it.
Where is it then, if we don't know what it is? Where is it?
It clumps. The important thing is it does clump. So there's more of it around here than there is halfway between us and the nearest Andromeda, the nearest other galaxy. So it's stuff that likes to clump.
Yeah. I mean, we don't know exactly how because it's dark.
That's right.
So we only, I mean, when you can't see it, it's hard to tell where it is. You can only tell where it is by indirect means. And the way you tell where it is by the motions it causes, because it gravitates. And so it produces motions. Okay. I mean, and you measure the motions of the things you can see, and that tells you where the stuff is that you can't see.
So unlike dark energy, which has even more diffuse predictions.
Yeah.
And you say
dark energy is even...
That's harder.
But dark matter, you can map out. It's not easy, because you have to measure motions of things you do see, and you have to develop the techniques to actually interpret those measurements. I mean, the dark matter, we think, is clustered in a way that's similar to the way the light-emitting stuff is clustered for all that we can measure, although on very large scales the measurements leave something to be desired. The dark energy, I mean, I don't think anybody really knows what it is, how it's distributed.
And we should talk a little bit about why we think there is dark energy. What is the observational evidence for that? I mean, there's some theoretical suggestions and there's some observational evidence for that because nobody ordered dark energy.
No, the theory was zero until recently, until the experimenters produced some evidence.
And what was the evidence?
Well, a bunch of originally particle physicists turned astronomers, as well as some astronomers who remained astronomers, realized that a certain type of supernova is usually of the same brightness or more or less of the same brightness.
Yeah, it has the same peak brightness.
The same peak brightness. And therefore, it's kind of a standard candle. And you could use it. You can measure its redshift, that is to say, how fast it's moving away from us, and you could measure its distance by measuring its brightness. And by comparing these, you could determine whether the universe is decelerating, that is to say, whether the expansion of the universe is slowing down, as everyone and his mother expected, or not. And it turned out to be not. The universe is expanding ever more rapidly, because the dark energy is becoming more important relative to the dark mass.
And it's a very peculiar kind of energy that acts like a repulsive gravitational force, which is...
A better description, which will shed no light, is a negative pressure.
Yeah,
negative pressure.
It's like a rubber band, right?
Yes,
it has negative pressure.
It's not a repulsive thing between massive objects. That is to say, two galaxies attract each other no matter how far apart they are. So it doesn't.
Yes.
It's not that the attraction changes to a repulsion.
No. Right.
It's that space itself is repelling itself, so to speak.
But ordinary energy acts like mass in that it makes space want to contract. So this is not an ordinary
energy.
Since it's sending parts of the universe away from each other?
It's causing
the space to stretch more rapidly, as time goes on.
Which, incidentally, is something that used to be happening, we think, when the universe was extremely
young.
Right. It was in a period of exponential expansion. Then things quieted down for a long time, 15 billion years ago, and now it's starting to exponentially expand again. So there was just this narrow period of 15 billion years or so when things were the way they are now.
Well, I'm Ted O'Brien, and this is Boston University's World of Ideas. Our guests are Alan Lightman from MIT, Margaret Geller from the Smithsonian Astrophysical Laboratory in Cambridge, and Sheldon Glashow from Boston University. Earlier this year in February at the Brookhaven National Laboratory, an experiment was conducted that was expected to be pretty routine. The way a muon wobbled in a magnetic field was being measured. a muon is in the same class of particles as the electron, but it exists for only a very short time.
No, a muon is a microscopic cow. You mean a muon.
A muon. All right. But what happened was that the muon didn't wobble the way the standard model said it was supposed to. So, is this another challenge to the standard model? And again, this was all of a couple of months ago. So where do things stand now? Has it led to any new conceptual breakthrough?
No, absolutely not. First of all, it's an experiment in which a leading role was carried out by my colleagues at Boston University. It's to a large extent a BU experiment. And they have this departure from expectations, this anomaly, this discrepancy. But at the moment, they're only about 90% or 95% confident in the results to their analysis. That's not enough to convince people that there really is an anomaly. That's the bad news. The good news is that they have in the bank, so to speak, 2 more years of running of this experiment. And within 1 year, approximately 1 year, they will have analyzed the rest of the data. And if things hold up, instead of a 95% confidence that there is an anomaly, which means 5% that they could be wrong, it will be a 99.99% confidence if things work out well. At that point, we can say with certainty, virtual certainty, that there is something wrong with our theory that has to be fixed, that needs a change, that needs something, but we don't quite know what it is.
And that's how science advances, by running into anomalies and then working.
Oh, we love them, yes.
Yes,
to explain
by running
them.
Into contradictions to
that's
what
you thought
was true.
That's when you start learning new things.
But you have to keep an open mind, and you can't get too married to a theory, string or otherwise, or it can blind you to change.
Well, individual scientists don't particularly keep open minds.
Yes.
It's the collection of scientists who love to criticize each other that yields the scientific method.
Yeah, I mean, the scientific method that you learn in school, I always...
No, that's not
it has nothing to do with the way scientists actually work on things. I think every scientist who does a problem has a preconceived notion of the answer before they start. Otherwise, it's not worth doing. And the problem is you to recognize when your preconceived notion doesn't mesh with the things you've computed or the things you observe, and that's very hard for people to work that way. But there is no such thing.
I disagree with you, Margaret. There is such a thing as the scientific method that we learned in high school.
There is. But who uses it?
Who uses it is certain drug companies who assume that drug XYZ will cure leprosy, and then they make tests. It's the hypothesis, XYZ cures leprosy. Then they do a bunch of experiments, and they find that XYZ either does or does not cure leprosy. So that is the old-fashioned scientific
method. Yeah, there is that, but I think that it's not really, it's rather infrequent.
Well, not to ignore the muon, if, in fact, it turns out to be 99.99%.
If there's really an anomaly there, yes.
Then what?
Well, certain of my colleagues think that it means that supersymmetry is correct. Supersymmetry is a generalization of the theory we have now, a sort of conventional modification of the theory, but a very exciting one. And if supersymmetry is right, it should have many consequences at accelerators that are being built and at the Tevatron near Chicago. And these people will argue that the departure from, it's called G minus 2 of the muon, from its theoretical value suggests that supersymmetry is correct. So that's one indication, one way.
But we've introduced a new term here.
Supersymmetry.
And that's supersymmetry. Who wants to take that one?
These are particle things.
Okay.
There are big things and small things, and I'm at this table responsible
for everything small.
Smaller things. But so are you, Alan. But, well, let's see. Supersymmetry, when it first came out, I thought it was rather silly because it said that there are twice as many particles as we thought in nature, that every particle came both, to put it simply, with and without spin. So, for example, electrons have spin, and there would be C-electrons, supersymmetric electrons, that don't have spin, and there would be quarks and squarks. There would be up quarks and sub quarks and down quarks and stown quarks. And
for,
then there
for
are
every item, there's an equal and opposite number.
We knows, okay. W particles would have we knows, but none of these crazy things, quarks and electrons, or neutrinos or stop quarks, none of stop squarks, none of these things have been found.
But some are candidates for dark matter. Right.
Some of them are conjectured to be candidates for dark matter. So here we have this whole theory that predicts a zillion new particles, none of which we've seen, one of which is the lightest one, which has to be stable, which can be dark matter. But this is super supersymmetry is super speculative until we start seeing some of the predicted particles, and that's what big accelerators are for.
Wasn't the development of supersymmetry, wasn't it part of the effort to find a quantum theory of gravity?
The supersymmetry was originally invented per se as a generalization of the laws we had applicable at low energy, but people who do superstring theory realized that theories that did attempt to explain gravity, had to incorporate supersymmetry as well. Mm. So string theory requires supersymmetry. Mm-hmm. Now, that supersymmetry can live at super high energies and be unobservable, or it could live at low energies and make observable effects. We don't know which is the case. It would be much more fun and much easier for us to study physics if the supersymmetric particles are accessible to being seen.
What are your candidates for the new and revolutionary in physics today and in astronomy?
Well, one, I think, would be have to do with the understanding of the dark matter and dark energy, and in particular the challenge of identifying the nature of the particles or structures which comprise the dark mass of the universe. That's perhaps number one. But also number one in my field is to discover the mechanism in nature that produces mass, the mechanism by which particles get their mass. This might involve the so-called Higgs boson, which might have been seen at the great European accelerator, which has been demolished. But it was not really seen. It was just a glimpse. It may be seen at the Tevatron. It may certainly be seen, if it exists, at Europe's Large Hadron Collider. Tune in 2007.
All right.
That's the second great problem. Now it's your turn for a problem.
Well, I would say a great problem in astrophysics is understanding the formation of the objects that we observe in the universe, from planets to stars to galaxies, that to the larger structures
to
that we observe.
To accreting black holes
All of these objects, I mean, we really don't understand the formation. I think one of the places where some of the greatest progress has been made is actually in understanding planet formation. And there's been enormous progress there in recent years, and we haven't touched on that subject. But in fact, in recent years, there's been sort of a revolution in our understanding of our own solar system. We've recognized, due to the discovery of the Kuiper Belt, that our solar system is a lot larger than we thought. And that realization has given us a way to relate our solar system to the other systems that we see around other stars. So I think these kinds of things are very important issues
in connection with that,
astrophysics.
I believe that NASA and others plan to launch a device to search for terrestrial planets. And so we can not just find these very large Jupiter-sized planets that we've been finding so far, but we might have a hope of seeing Earth-sized planets.
Yeah, and I mean, people see disks around other stars, and you can see the early stages of planet formation around other stars, and by observing those, we'll be able to understand how our own system formed. So I think questions of formation, whether it be planets or the origin of the universe itself, are kinds of questions that will be very important.
Professor Lightman, your choice.
Well, I would nominate two problems that are most interesting to me. One of them may be related to Shelley's question of how did the particles, the fundamental particles, get mass. And that is that when we calculate what the dark energy should be from first principles using basic quantum mechanics and relativity, the basic physics that we know, we come up with a number that is much, much, much larger than what we measure. whether the actual dark energy is zero or whether it's what it seems to be from the supernova experiments, both of those are far smaller than what our theoretical calculations suggest it should be. And there's something about the theory, our basic theory, it may be the standard model, there's something that is missing that we don't understand. And that's exciting. The other question that I have, which is maybe far off into the future, but philosophically it's extremely interesting to me, is whether the laws of physics that we have developed over the century, the basic laws of quantum mechanics, of relativity, the basic constants of nature, the value of the speed of light, 186,000 miles per second, the number of dimensions of space that we have, whether this is just an accident, whether with other universes that have different values for these, or whether when we understand all of the laws of physics and have measured all the constants, we will realize that that mathematical consistency would not allow them to be any other way than what they are, that we are in the only universe possible. And I don't know whether this question is answerable or not, but I can think of a way in which it might be answerable. It's an extremely interesting question. It's sort of on the border between philosophy and science, but it's one that interests me.
Professor Alan Lightman of MIT, Margaret Geller from the Smithsonian Astrophysical Laboratory, and Sheldon Glashow, Boston University. In his now classic book, The First 3 Minutes, which discusses the Big Bang, Steven Weinberg, your classmate at Bronx Science, Professor Glashow.
And at Cornell.
And who also won the Nobel Prize at the same time you did.
Coincidence.
Closes with this comment. The more the universe seems comprehensible, the more it also seems pointless. But the effort to understand the universe is one of the very few things that lifts human life a little above the level of farce and gives it some of the grace of tragedy. Do you agree? Disagree? I guess what I'm asking is, when we step back and try to look at the whole picture, what does it mean, and is it even possible to know what it means?
Well, of course, remember that when we attend a play, we each have our own opinion about the nature of the play. I myself find the universe to be rather a delight, and the enterprise of trying to understand things about it to be an unbounded joy. But do I agree with it? I think I've answered that.
I guess that I resonate with what Shelley said, and I think that actually there are many human endeavors, fortunately, which make our lives and our ability to understand our lives worth living. I think science is only one of the ways that we define ourselves. There's art, there's theater, there's novels, and I think that we are part, when we explore the universe, that we're really part of that extraordinary richness that we have as human beings.
And you, Professor Lightman, have written of one of your fictional characters who is half body, half mind. He could no more describe what his thinking was than a great ballerina could say how she does a pirouette. I don't think that applies to you, so maybe you could tell us your response to that.
Well, I'll give an answer to your question that refers to other people. About 15 years ago, I interviewed some of the leading cosmologists in the world about many aspects of their work and their beliefs in science. Margaret was one of the people I interviewed, and eventually was published in a book. And I wanted to ask them this question about whether they thought the universe had a point. I mean, I was partly interested in their religious associations. And the way that I asked the question was by quoting the same quote from Weinberg that you quoted, because I felt that by using Weinberg as a mediator, a very well-respected physicist, that these 30 cosmologists would feel that the question had been legitimized and therefore would respond to it. And what I found was there was a great variety of answers to this question. some people, some cosmologists cited their religious beliefs. And by the way, I think that it's been documented that scientists have the same degree of religiosity as the general public. Some scientists said that there's no point in it, that the universe is an accident, that searching for meaning in the universe is just an anthropomorphic tendency, and so on. And so I found a huge range of responses to the question, which I think said to me, and this is consistent with many other observations I've made, is that there is no single character type which is the scientist. The scientists come in as many different ranges of personality and character types and beliefs as any other person. There is a belief that the universe is knowable, I think, and this is one constant factor in the scientific mentality. But once you start going beyond that, you find that there's a huge range of scientific personalities, and that was a pleasure for me, this range of responses. Science has always been a human endeavor, and the findings of science tell us something about ourselves as well as about physical reality outside of ourselves.
Alan, I think there's another second common feature that most of the scientists that you interviewed probably have, and that is that they feel it is not really a religious sentiment, but partially so, that it is their duty to strive to understand the universe they were born to as best they can.
Well, on that note, I will thank you all and remind our audience, you've been listening to Boston University's World of Ideas. Perhaps tonight we should call it the Universe of Ideas. Our guests have been Dr. Margaret Geller, senior scientist at the Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory, MIT professor of science and writing Alan Lightman, and Boston University professor of physics Sheldon Glashow, holder of a Nobel Prize for Physics. Join us again next week. For a cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes are $15, including shipping and handling. Visit our website at wbur.org and wrni.org. Our webmaster is Angel Cazelli. Tonight's program was produced by Vince Fairchild and Bob Zalisk. I'm Ted O'Brien. Thanks for being with us.
This is WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. Stay tuned just ahead at 10 o'clock after the news. It's BBC Assignment. And then at 10:30, it's EuroQuest. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the Gamma Knife Center at New England Medical Center, providing an alternative to invasive surgery through precisely focused radiosurgery technology. Details at bostongammaknifecenter.org. In the forecast,